Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Legendarium podcast. I am Craig Hanks, your host. And as we ease into today's topic, let me tell you a little story first. And that comes from way back at the beginning of the show. Gosh, this would have been 2014, 2015, something like that. And I had a few people on, some friends of mine who were big fans of horror movies, horror books, all, you know, the whole horror genre. And I had them on because I not that I had any issue with the genre, I just wasn't very well versed in it. I wanted to learn a little bit more about it and kind of arm myself to then go out and get more of a hands-on education in horror. And it worked out great. Those are actually some really fun episodes. I think we did two of them back in the day. Anyway, that conversation put me on a certain track and I felt like I got some education. And today's conversation is kind of in the same vein, although it's a very different vein, right? Today we're talking about romance, romance stories, romance novels in fantasy and sci-fi. And I have kind of the same goal now as I did then. But to help me out with that, I have Freya Marsk with me. Freya, how are you?
Hello. Good morning for me. Good evening for you. I'm doing well.
It is. Yeah, we are very, very far away from each other. Freya, you are in Australia. And it's going to be an odd conversation because I named my daughter Freya, and I'm not used to calling anybody else that. It's a if not unique name, it's unusual enough that I don't ever talk to any other Freyas except for that one. So this should be interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of younger Freyas around. There's not very many of my age that I meet.
Yes, they're going to be more of them for sure. Well, Freya, you are the author of a what are we calling it? It's a queer historical fantasy series. It's a three
That's
books,
it.
And we
it.
Just had the second one come out, right?
Yes, yeah. So the first okay. book, A Marvelous Light, came out last year, and the second book, A Restless Truth, just came out about a month ago.
Oh, man. Okay. So people can check that out. And we are going to talk a little bit more about that either in the conversation as we go or at the end of it, because we want to hear more about what these books are. But let's start at like a 30,000 foot view or even just lay the groundwork as, you know, if we're going to mix metaphors, let's just really go for it. Let's lay some groundwork on what is romance definitionally, you know, how we're going to be talking about it. And I'm going to read you a definition that I found in the most reliable place possible, the internet. Of what a romance story is. Number one, there are two rules for a romance story, according to this website that shall remain nameless. A central love story between characters. And number two is an emotionally satisfying happy ending. Which I thought was interesting. Do you agree with this definition?
So this is a definition that is coming from a very specific place. Mm. And I like your idea of taking a 30,000 foot view, because if you look down on the landscape of fiction publishing, we have this continent that is romance, genre romance, capital R. And that definition that you read is the accepted definition of what is a romance book. It has to have essential romance between characters. Nothing to say how many characters there are or what genders they are, just essential romance and that emotionally satisfying happy ending. There is then a sense to talk about what is a romance plot or a romantic subplot. And I think once you start getting into that, you can mess with some of those things a little bit. So a romantic subplot or a romantic story may not have that happy ending. But I think if you want to put a story out there and say, this is a romance, capital R, it does have to fulfill those criteria. And so I'm somebody who's writing from a place of loving science fiction and fantasy, but also really liking romance as a genre and always having been drawn to romantic subplots in science fiction and fantasy. And the space where I'm writing is a little bit ill-defined at the moment, but I've seen people throwing the word romantasy around, which is a lovely smushing together of romance and fantasy, which I think we're using that a slightly odd word to distinguish it from fantasy romance, which is an established, you know, country in the continent of romance, which has its own expectations. I think if somebody handed you a fantasy romance, that would say certain things about how prominent the romance would be, what kind of story might be in the background. But romanticy and fantasy romance are becoming more indistinguishable from each other. It often just depends where in the bookshop this book is meant to be shelved.
Isn't that the case with so many genres? It just comes down to what the marketers at the booksellers decide rather than what the author wrote.
It's the nature of at least traditional publishing that you have to prove that this is a part of the existing market. Whereas I think because self-publishing has become so much more prominent and hybrid publishing is becoming much bigger, people have been publishing these books that occupy a bit of an odd genre space because they want them and they know that there is a readership for them. And traditional publishing has turned around and gone, oh, okay, you know, there is actually some demand for this. And so now it has carved itself a space in traditional publishing as well, which is great for me because that's what I write. Man.
How did you start out? Did you do the self-pub route or did you go traditional? How did it work out for you?
I went straight through traditional. So when I wrote my first book, which was even more of a mess than A Marvelous Light when it comes to what genre it's in, because it was a secondary world fantasy that had no magical elements. It was just a secondary world, but there was no dragons or magic or anything. And it was a romance as well, but it had like a plot about corporate espionage. It was a wonderful book, I think. I was writing exactly the book that I wanted to read, and it got me an agent. And my agent said, okay, let's send this to some romance publishers, and we'll send it to some fantasy publishers. And the romance publishers said, we don't know what genre this is. And the fantasy publishers said, this isn't proper fantasy. We don't really know what this is. But all the while I was writing A Marvelous Light with the intention of it being much more easy to define. So as you said, you can call the series queer historical fantasy, and historical fantasy is a very well-defined genre with a long history.
Yeah.
And so I was just taking queer romances and shoving them into the pillowcase of historical fantasy, which worked out obviously much better.
So what drew you initially to the genre and when? You know, how old were you when you started reading, consuming romance stuff? And then what was it that kind of grabbed you?
So I only started reading genre romance in my 20s. And I think it was because I'd grown up as a big science fiction and fantasy reader. I knew I liked the ones that had the love stories in them, but I didn't think of myself as a romance reader. And I think there's probably a bit of internalized misogyny there, this sense that, oh, that's like, you know, that's not a genre to be taken seriously. That's silly books. They're probably not well written. They're for girls. And I'm a fantasy reader. That's not for me. And in my 20s, I discovered I was very wrong about that and delighted in discovering some romance readers and writers and the whole community out there. I'd also been spending a lot of time in fandom, and I did a lot of reading and writing of fan fiction with a very strong romantic bent. I think that was what managed to push me into romance as a genre, was the realization that the stories that I was reading and writing were basically romance. And here's a whole area of publishing I hadn't explored yet. And here's a whole lot of books. And so, yeah, I sort of tumbled headfirst into romance and had a wonderful time. And then it came to me that what I really wanted when it came to reading was I wanted to read books that had all of the things I enjoy about science fiction and fantasy, but I also really wanted those strong romance central plots with really good characterization and character journeys. And I wanted both. And so, like many people do, I set out to write the book I wanted to see in the world.
Which is, that's exactly how I don't know about should, but how it often goes is, you know, you enjoy consuming this thing, whatever it happens to be, and then it's almost inevitable that you start wanting to generate your own version of that stuff. It's, you know, maybe it's just that you want to have the satisfaction of writing that type of story that you enjoy consuming. Maybe it's you feel that there's something missing from the genre, and I can be the person to add this type of voice or this type of story into the mix. Which way was it for you? Do you try to break out of a lot of, you know, the tropes that you grew up reading, or, you know, in your 20s, I suppose, or are you trying to break out of those, or kind of tell more traditional stories that that aren't going to be so surprising? Does this make sense?
Look, romance is
Follow the rules of the genre or break them?
Yeah. Look, if you want to be marketed to romance readers, you have to follow the rules. But I think romance is such a trope-driven genre. Like, I think science fiction and fantasy often is to some extent as well. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it's about, there's something about the key shape of a story that we find appealing. So, for example, a romance trope that I really like is arranged marriage or marriage of convenience. And it's because it's shorthand for two people who never expected to have to be in a position of intimacy with each other, coming together and having to discover that they do have a relationship after all. Like, there are certain beats that you might expect through an arranged marriage romance, and you can draw any romance trope that you want into science fiction and fantasy and build your central relationship or your romance about it. Two books that have used that particular trope, the arranged marriage trope, recently in science fiction and fantasy are Winter's Orbit by Evrena Maxwell and A Strange and Stubborn Endurance by Fos Meadows. And those are both also writing queer romance, and because that's the place that I usually work in, I often mostly read queer romance as well. And there's something to be said for taking the old traditional tropes that have been done and done and done and saying, well, hang on, we queer people haven't had a chance to do those yet. Let us at them. And so I think it's not a matter of saying this is tired or I want to reinvent the wheel entirely. It's about saying, let's just see how many things we can pile onto each other. I feel like I'm bringing new things into science fiction and fantasy, not that I'm trying to think about how to say this.
Yeah, you're not trying to reinvent the wheel, like you said. Just get it to roll a little better in your direction. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really an attitude of just like, more cake is good, and so I'm taking the cake of fantasy and the cake of romance and the cake of, you know, happy endings for queer people, and just making a nice layer with all of them, rather than saying I need to start discarding things. Let's just see how much I can fit into one book, which probably explains why my books, when their first draft form at least, tend very long.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Well, I mean, you wouldn't be a fantasy author if you didn't turn in, you know, a draft with, I don't know, a typical draft would be 150,000 words. Fantasy author draft would have to be 385,000 words.
You gotta never match gotten Tolkien. Quite that bad, thank goodness. But I know I am very much an overwriter, so there's always one level of revisions is, and now we take out 5,000 to 10,000 words.
Oh, yeah. Which I'm sure hurts, but you just remember this is all for the benefit of the story.
It's but satisfying.
I asked you how you got into the genre, but let me ask a slightly different question, because I remember one of the key lessons in my life that I learned in my early 20s, and this applies to so many things, is it matters less why you started than why you stayed, or, you know, why you kept doing the thing, right? So if you've been doing something for a long time, whether, you know, consuming or writing or whatever, it can be as illuminating or interesting to consider why do I keep reading this stuff? Why do I keep writing this stuff? And gosh, I have the topics for me that I would need to examine my own answers, but I'm curious for you, is there a different answer for, you know, why it has continued to be so important to you through your life, you know, reading and writing these kinds of stories? Is there a different answer for why you keep doing it than why you started doing it?
Well, I can't exactly pretend that I'm, you know, a long-careered veteran, given I only have two books out. So far, I'm writing things because I still enjoy them. And I do anticipate that I'll keep writing things that have fairly central romances in them. In terms of why we keep reading them, part of it is that guarantee that you know you're going into something that's going to leave you in a place of joy. And that is a guarantee that you get when you pick up something that says this is a romance. And I think, you know, all different types of books have their places. I love reading. I do like horror. I like mysteries. I like the occasional, you know, work of capital L literature that's going to rip my heart out. But I like to know how I'm going to feel at the end of a book. And when you pick up something that has a strong romance in it and that guarantee of a romance with a capital R, you do know how you're going to feel at the end. And given the stuff we have gone through in the last few years, I have found myself turning more and more to books that are going to leave me feeling hopeful and joyful rather than
I love that.
I need to lie down and stare at the ceiling for 3 days recovering the shreds of my emotional life.
It's so interesting to... Oh, sorry. No, please continue.
Oh, no. I mean, you can respond to that part. The other thing I was going to say is that the reason I keep reading them is because if somebody is determined to do a strong fantasy, a strong romance plot, it means that they care deeply about the characters. And I've always been somebody who enjoys very character-forward books. And, you know, there's a lot of scope in science fiction and fantasy for idea-driven books, especially in sci-fi. And sometimes it's really just about... here's an interesting idea, let's explore it. Or sometimes it's here's an interesting plot, let's explore that. But I bounce off those if I don't really care about the characters. And by the very nature of building a romance plot, you have to know the characters deeply and portray certain changes in them throughout the book. And I think people who can do that well are people who understand human nature and understand character and how to manipulate a reader with character. And so I always feel like I'm in safe hands as a reader, if I'm reading a book that's doing a romance well.
That's so interesting. I want to get, I don't know if we're in a position to do this right now, but I kind of want to get really philosophical about this concept you bring up and take a book that is concept driven, you know, maybe a hard sci-fi novel or, you know, some intensely subcreative fantasy, you know, a secondary world fantasy or something that is more about the plot, the setting than it is the characters, you know, maybe the magic or the science or whatever. And I'm curious if there is an example of a book that, you know, along those lines that would not be made stronger with a heavier emphasis on the characters. To me, in my mind, it feels axiomatic that the better the characters are, the better the story is going to be. The more well thought out, the more fully realized the characters are, the more believable their interactions, the better the book is going to be. Now I'm kind of going through my mind wondering if that really is axiomatic or...
I think it depends on the size of the story that's being told as well, because some stories really do lend themselves to sprawling casts. You know, the ideas in the plot are so large that you do need a lot of different moving pieces to tell them. And the point of that story is not necessarily following one or two major characters. I think by its very nature, romance requires quite a lot of interiority of a character or characters. And so if you're trying to juggle an enormous cast and a big, big timeline, you know, fate of worlds, then maybe you haven't quite got the time to focus in on one or two people or three people and how they feel. You can do it, but it takes space. So one author who I've really enjoyed, who's done this quite well, is Jen Lyons, whose Chorus of Dragons series is five books, solid, high fantasy, dragons, prophecies, rebirths, battles. But she has stubbornly inserted a really satisfying romance in there. It's just taken all five books because you've got so much other shit going on. You only occasionally get these little scenes where the main character and his love interests actually get to interact and move the romance forward. Whereas I think I'm a little bit more impatient. Oh, I don't know if I could write a five book series, but certainly the trilogy that I'm writing isn't doing one love story. I am stealing something from historical fantasy, from historical romance, which is that you have a plot that goes across a series, but each book is a different couple's romance. And I wanted to do that because I am impatient and I like to read a single book and have a romance take place, beginning, end, put it down, huh, feel better, especially if it's going to be released a year apart like mine are. So A Marvelous Light followed the romance of one couple, A Restless Truth follows a different couple, and the third book coming out next year will follow a different couple again. But I am still building a romance trilogy, so there is still a plot and a danger and world building and secrets being uncovered that build up on each other through the series. Mm. And by the time we get to book three, the reason it was going to be quite a bit longer is because I have to do all of that on the page romance work. But I also now have four or five other characters from the previous books who are going to insist on taking part in the plot. And so it's a lot more of an ensemble book that I've also had to fit the romance in. So that one's going to be a bit longer than the other two, I think.
The third one, yeah. Yeah, I can see how that it builds over time. I mean, it's something that fantasy readers are well familiar with, I'd say. So look, nobody's going to ding you for that, that's for sure.
No. And look, you know, to your first point, the place where people are inserting romances into ideas-driven media is fan fiction. That's where that is happening. Mm. You know, the kinds of things that lend themselves to large fandoms are often speculative, either books or TV shows or movies that have really interesting ideas, but don't have space within them to actually explore characters and romance in depth. And one, like, there's a film that got a fandom that I think would be surprisingly outsized if you didn't really know how fandom works, which was the movie Inception.
Oh, sure.
Which is very idea-driven. And yeah, it's got some characters in it, but the characters are by their very nature fairly archetypal because they're there to play very specific roles in this very idea-driven movie. But Inception has a huge fanfic fandom which said, well, we really like this idea of dreams and Inception and things there. Let's take some of the characters and really dig into them as people and, you know, make them more three-dimensional than they are on the page. And so there's a lot of, you know, well, fandom's just going to agree that this is what this person is like on very loose evidence on the screen. But it comes from that desire to say, here's something that's very ideas-driven. I would have liked to see more character, more romance, more depth. I'm going to do it myself.
Fan fiction is a, it's a world I've only ever dipped my toes into. But you're not the first person in the last, even just the last couple of months to tell me that there's a whole vibrant subculture out there. Many, many vibrant subcultures. So dang it. Maybe now I have to look into fanfic. As though I didn't have enough to read already, Freya. Thanks a lot. Okay, thank you very much.
Look, most people get into it because they need an itch scratched. And, like, you know, one of my earlier fandoms was the new Battlestar Galactica show. And that was really coming from a place of, there's a romance happening here that's not happening fast enough for my liking. I'm going to go online. Someone will have written this. And they had. And so I spent a couple of delightful years rolling around in that fandom because it was, again, it's something that's quite plot driven, ideas driven. They're great characters in that show, but sometimes you just want it to linger on the aspects of it that the TV show itself is not quite as interested in.
Yeah. Well, let me shift gears. I want to go back to something that you mentioned about the idea that that romance it all but guarantees that happy, satisfying ending. You know, even if it's not purely happy, it's at least emotionally satisfying and generally probably happy, I think is fair to say. And you also said that one of the reasons you like that, especially in the last couple of years, is because of, you know, all the stuff that's going on, right? You know, I assume you're talking about COVID and populism and, you know, social upheaval of this and that variety, right? And it's nice to have a spot to kind of retreat to, right? I don't know how well-versed you are in the historical ebbs and flows of romantic fiction, but I am curious if you can answer this question for me. Do you feel like there are ebbs and flows based on what's going on in the world at large, you know, within a certain community, within a certain nation? Does, you know, if we go back to the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and on through, do we see ebbs and flows based on what's going on in the world as people want to retreat to something happy Or is it just a sturdy, well-selling genre forever and always?
I don't think I know enough about it to say. I'm not a romance scholar, of which there are people. I do know that I think sales of romance have been higher than ever in the last few years, but they have always been very high. It's always been a very well-selling genre. I think it is very reasonable to say from what I've seen and read and heard that, yes, it has definitely gone up in sales and more people have found it because of that sense of retreat. At the same time, there are ebbs and flows of themes within the romance genre itself that also respond to things that are going on in the world. And I think if you looked at some of the books that have been published in romance in the last few years, there is an enormous sense of anger. You know, angry people, especially angry women, wanting to find their happiness and seize their happiness and change the world, or in spite of the world. And that's because it's not just about escape and running away to a happiness that we can't find. It's about romance being an expression of the feelings that we're having. And so even though you know it's going to have a happy ending, the kinds of characters you see and the kinds of things that those characters are fighting against, I think that has changed. And, you know, for example, there's always been this trope of the billionaire romance. And I think if you looked at the average romance reader these days, sure, you know, you still, the Cinderella fantasy is still very alive, but there's maybe a little bit more of a tendency to look hard at that and say, can you actually ever have a billionaire who is ethical to the point that they make a good romance hero?
Because
we're not particularly into billionaires, really.
At least not today.
No, and that's the thing. Like, you have to say romance is a genre about fantasy in one sense. And yes, in romance, you can have someone who's a billionaire and is still a good person and has somehow come by that money ethically, or at least is doing something moral with it. But I mean, that's just one example, I think, again, because I don't read quite as widely in the romance genre as the average romance reader. I read mostly queer things and I read a lot less overall because I am also reading a lot of science fiction and fantasy. I don't think I can make a blanket statement about trends in the genre, but I have definitely noticed that it's not that we're running away into things that are cozy and warm and it's just all about forgetting your troubles. It's about, this has always been a genre about seizing things as well as retreating from things.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great comment. Let me ask you a question that does, dear listener, acknowledge, as NPR would say, this segment acknowledges the existence of sex. So, you know, if you got your 7-year-old in the car, you know, give it a little while. I don't know. But I do want to ask you about sensuality and sexuality in the romance genre, because we can't not have a conversation about romance without at least digging into this a little bit. Where do you fall on where do you draw your line in the sand? What do you like to see versus what, you know, what can people expect to see maybe in the genre as a whole when it comes to sex, sensuality, that sort of thing? How do you view that just as a topic? And then we'll drill down.
Oh, look, it's so personal. There are some people who really enjoy romance stories that don't have any, what they would call low heat romance, where there's still an emotionally satisfying story, but maybe all you see on the page is a kiss or not even a kiss. And yeah, so if you look at people in the romance genre, they will talk about heat levels across romance, everything from very, very low heat to erotic romance, which is going to be mostly sex scene. You know, per page, there's going to be a predominantly, that's what the book is. And there is everything in between because people have different preferences for that. Personally, I enjoy reading sex scenes. I enjoy writing sex scenes. I'm writing much higher heat than the average fantasy reader is probably used to. But I'm writing things at a level that would not be at all surprising to a romance reader who read the average romance that is published these days. And it was interesting making the deliberate decision to do that in a fantasy novel, because growing up reading fantasy, my experience of sex on the page was usually pretty dark. Like, there wasn't a great deal of interest in the high fantasy books that I was reading of portraying joyful, prolonged sex. It was more about, if it was something that was going to be described in detail, it was unfortunately usually going to be sexual violence. And that was what the book was interested in lingering on. And there may have been a romance subplot as well, but you never got that happy sex, with a few exceptions. But I think the more I got older and the more I realized that I did what I enjoyed about reading romance, I said, well, look, you can actually do this in other genres as well. And you can pull it into a fantasy book and it can have a place there. And yeah, again, it's about me writing what I like to read and writing what I wanted to see. But again, it will mean that my books are not for everybody, because not everybody really wants to read it. Some people will read it and hit the scene and go, oh, okay, this part's not for me. And for me, I'll say you'll miss quite a lot of the character development and characterization. And there's some important stuff that happens in those scenes. But they're not for everybody. And some people will look at them and go, I'm not going to read this because I don't want to read that. And some people will go, ooh, sex and fantasy, that sounds fun. And they'll pick it up because of that. But that's the same of any aspect of a book. You have to know what the selling points are so that the people who are your ideal reader will find it.
And now I have this idea of like a thermometer icon or something, you know, like the parental advisory stickers that we have in the US or something like that, where on the back of every romance novel, there's a heat rating?
Low to high. You're putting your finger on something that the romance genre has been, kind of every so often we'll have this debate sort of half, quite lightheartedly about heat rating stickers. But most romance review sites will have some kind of rating scale whether it's little Chili Peppers or whether it's Flames, because that is something that romance readers want to know. So reviewers, authors,
I just want eggplant emojis.
Eggplant emojis. Yeah. Yeah, but it is part of the marketing of genre romance. It's not part of the marketing of fantasy books, because there's not an expectation within the fantasy genre. But you're absolutely right. The heat scale is part of the marketing of a romance book.
Oh man, this is so much fun, and I want to. I actually, legitimately, I really do want to get a little bit more of a self-education in romance and what it is and how it works and who the major players are and the subgenres you can get into. So let me ask you this. I asked you before we started recording to maybe think about a few starting points that people can jump in with, and myself included. So give us, if you would, just a couple of books and authors that, ranging in the Scoville ratings, the heat ratings. What do you got for us? Where should people jump into romantic fantasy genre?
Romantic fantasy. Romantasy? Yeah, so I think most of the recommendations I'll give are ones that would probably be found on the fantasy shelf, but they have what I think of as very strong romance plots. One of the writers working today who I think does this very well is Tasha Suri. Her first couple of books, Empire of Sand and Realm of Ash, both are fantasy novels that have really nice, satisfying romances in them. And her new series, which started with The Jasmine Throne, also has a really good romance at its heart. I mentioned Everina Maxwell, who writes science fiction, sort of space opera romance. Winter's Orbit is the first one, and her second book, Ocean's Echo, also just came out last month. They are very strong in the romance tropes, but they have really fun space opera world building and plots around them as well. So if you like science fiction or space opera and want to dip your toe into romance, that is where I'd start. For things that are, I guess, on the low heat side of things, T.J. Clune writes sort of light fantasy that usually has a queer romance in it. I think his book Under the Whispering Door is probably my pick for the ones he's written so far. And I think the book Legends and Lattes, which has come out this year, has gotten a lot of buzz as a very sort of low fantasy feel good, and it has a really nice central romance as well. and some of the sort of more high heat, like looking more at the romance really as being key. Two other books that came out recently are Foz Meadows' book, A Strange and Stubborn Endurance, which is one of the arranged marriage ones I told you about, and A Taste of Golden Iron by Alexandra Roland, also fantasy romance. But it's interesting, like there's always been people working in the genre who have had this influence. And one of my favorite writers of all time is Lois McMaster-Bujold, who wrote the Vorkosigan series and also wrote quite a lot of fantasy and is still writing. And she has been quite open about her influence coming from like Jane Austen, Georgette Heyer, who was the big Regency, almost invented the Regency historical romance as a genre. And one of the books in the Vorkosigan saga, A Civil Campaign, is very much an homage to Regency romance tropes. And I can't remember what the exact dedication is, but the dedication is to the romantic authors who influenced her. And one of them is Georgette, and I think Jane Austen is in there as well. So if you're prepared to pick up another sort of space opera that's very romance driven, obviously you should read the entire Vorkosigan saga, but A Civil Campaign is one that is very deliberately doing something with romance tropes.
Oh man. Now I want to say, you know, something like Jane Austen in space, like, this sounds great. Yeah,
that's kind of what's more or less. I mean, you know, space
and
opera.
Why not?
Yeah, space opera is the kind of science fiction that I think of as being character driven. Like, you know, it'll have elements of military sci-fi, maybe it'll have elements of adventure, but you're thinking about space as the setting for a large human story.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you've given me quite a nice list, and people probably heard me typing it out as you were talking. I'm sitting here writing down, actually typing as we're recording. So I've got a few titles that I'm going to go check out, but I should probably put at the top of my list A Marvelous Light and its sequel, A Restless Truth. So Freya, I want to ask you about your books. And you've kind of talked about them a little bit, but I wanted to give you a really solid shot to kind of elevator pitch us on your books and sell us, Freya, sell us these books.
Absolutely. So as you said, they are queer historical fantasy. They're set in England in 1908, and they're of the type of historical fantasy where we have a hidden society of magic users. So there's no sort of magic out in the open, but we have this hidden society of magic. And A Marvelous Light follows a young man who is accidentally named as the public service liaison to this magical society without knowing that magic exists. So he's our point of view character coming into magic for the first time. And his counterpart slash love interest is somebody who has grown up with magic but doesn't have very much of it. So he's a very low-powered magician, and the two of them have to work together to solve the mystery of where Robin, who's the young public servant's predecessor, has gone. Why was this job available? Why has he been put into it? There's magical curses. There's visions of the future. They have to go off to some magical estates in England and, you know, basically start to uncover this conspiracy of what's going on. So that one is very much about big manor houses and two people having to solve a mystery against a backdrop of suspicion and getting to know one another and discovering this world for the first time. A Restless Truth follows the younger sister of Robin, Maud, who we meet briefly in the first book. And now the conspiracy is sort of really underway. There's a lot more knowledge about what's going on. She has joined the adventure and she goes on a voyage to New York, where she meets an old lady who's involved in the backstory of all of this. And the entirety of book two, A Restless Truth, takes place on the voyage back. So from New York to England. And we're talking about the big ocean liners at the times of the Titanic. So I had to invent an ocean liner. It's not the Titanic, but I did steal quite a lot of details from the Titanic. She, again, has to uncover some more mysteries. She has to solve a murder, and she meets another magician by the name of Violet, who is coming back to England after working in the theatres in New York. And so their love story is a lot more fast-paced, lots of hijinks, lots of heists, lots of having to run around a ship and, you know, escape from danger and uncover things. So that was a lot of fun. That one was really the book I wrote during the first year of the pandemic lockdown, and I just wanted to write a romp. So A Marvelous Light is a little bit quieter. A Restless Truth is just chaos wall to wall, which was good fun. We will have a different set of narrators, but we'll involve all the characters from the first two books, and it will really bring the plot to a head. I've finished it. It's written. It just needs revisions. But I had a lot of fun with that one as well.
Yeah. And, you know, if these all sell really well, I'm looking forward to your trilogy becoming, you know, I'm thinking of like the Wheel of Time that eventually became 15 books out of a trilogy. And then you're going to have a cast of characters that's so big that you're going to be putting out 900 page, behemoths of fantasy romance novels.
I think I've very deliberately stopped the plot after book three, being like, okay, we fixed that. The other problem is...
You heard it here first, folks. Everybody dies in book three. Everybody dies.
No, it's a romance. It's a thing. You have to leave everybody together and alive and happy. The other problem is that because the second book is set in 1909, if I let the series go on for 17 books, we're going to hit World War I, which I'm not particularly interested in exploring in this series.
Fair enough. Well, it's a great pitch, Freya. Thank you so much. So I hope people will go check it out. It's A Marvelous Light is book one, and then A Restless Truth is the one that just came out. So please go check those out. Freya Marsk, thank you so much for taking a few minutes for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm always happy to come and evangelize about romance in fantasy spaces.
You know, as you say that, I realize that people are going to be mad at me that I didn't have Stephanie and Megan, or I should say Stephanie or Megan, or Ken. They all would have been great choices to accompany me on this interview, but, unfortunately, time frames didn't work out. But you're not the only one around here who wants to evangelize the romance genre. So you're a voice that we've now added to the chorus here at the Legendarium, and we much appreciate that. So for people who are interested in checking it out, go to the show notes. I will have Freya's website on there that you can check out. And then I will look for some of those books that you mentioned, and maybe put those in the show notes as well if people want to check those out. But really, you're the one who came on the show, so people should be buying your books. Okay, that's.
I mean, I do agree.
We have people rules. Should be buying people, my books. Okay. Yeah. So, all right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure you head to thelegendarium.com where you can check out links to all of our past episodes, including by author, by series. So, if you want to find out, which episode we talked about this or that author, you can do that at thelegendarium.com. You can also find the link to our Discord server, where there are about 1,500 other rabid sci-fi fantasy fans just like you, engaged in some of the most fun and friendly conversation on the internet. Lastly, at thelegendarium.com, you can find the link to our Patreon page. For those of you who support the show already, thank you so, so much. For those who haven't yet pulled that trigger, I encourage you to do so. Go check it out. You're going to get a ton of extras. Okay, that's a lie. There are no extras, but we do give you a bunch of free shows every month. So we hope that you'll put a dollar in the tip jar. But that will do it for us today. Once again, Freya Marsk, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.